From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a good chance the chicken you ate recently came from one of just a handful of companies in this country. That rotisserie chicken or those frozen pot pies in the grocery store, the chicken nuggets and strips at fast food restaurants. And it's not just chicken. Pepperoni, bacon, cold cuts in cafeterias and nursing homes, at posh neighborhood delis. The journalist Christopher Leonard says almost all of it comes from four companies. Among them is Tyson Foods, which Leonard says isn't just a company, it's a new system of agriculture. It's a perpetual motion machine that was designed to expand and control the market. Today in the program, Leonard is joining us to explain just how it works, this system, and the effect, he says, it's having on rural America and the country's middle class. The book is called The Meat Racket, after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to imagine it now, but it wasn't all that long ago that chicken was a luxury. At least if you didn't live on a farm, and even then, people didn't eat it like they do now. No, chicken was for special occasions and Sunday dinners. If you were a farmer, there wasn't much money in it. You had to grow enough chickens to make it worthwhile. But somewhere around the 30s or the 40s, they started building these big chicken houses and a market was born. But really, the system that has made chicken so ubiquitous in this country has come from one company in particular, Tyson Foods. In his new book, the journalist Christopher Leonard says Tyson isn't just a company, it's a new system of agriculture. He describes it as a perpetual motion machine. And he's joining us today to explain how a handful of companies have come to have such control over the country's meat supply and how Tyson mastered the economics of factory farming and how ultimately it's transformed rural America and the middle class. The book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Christopher Leonard is a fellow at the New America Foundation. That's a nonpartisan public policy think tank. For several years, he served as the national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. And he's joining us from NPR's studios in Washington, D.C. And Christopher Leonard, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I wanted to begin in the grocery store, because this is one of the points that you make early on in the book about the fact that for the average shopper, for most of us, when we go in looking for meat in general, chicken in particular, we'll talk about the fact that they're both sort of come into play here, but we're often fooled, you say, when we peruse the meat section. It looks like there are so many choices and so many products, but a big part of the book is the fact that that's not really true, that in terms of the choices that you're having.
That's right. It's a total illusion. You can walk through the meat aisle and see all these different brands. I mean, literally dozens of brands for all these different products. But what's hidden behind that, I mean, that's really an illusion of choice. But what happened in this country in the 70s, 80s, and 90s is that we had this sweeping wave of consolidation. Companies like Tyson Foods or IBP or Smithfield bought up all their competitors. But as they did so, they kept the competitors' brands. So a company like Tyson will just have a rainbow of different brands, but they all trace back to one company. And one company controls how that meat is produced and keeps the profits from the chain. And consumers lose real choice at the grocery store. Four companies today have more control over the meat industry than they've had at any point in U.S. history. I mean, 100 years ago, we had a really anti-competitive situation where these four companies called the Meat Trust totally dominated the market. And today, the business is even more consolidated than that. I mean, four companies make over 85% of all the beef in the United States. Just three companies make almost half the chicken in the United States, and four companies make 65% of all the pork. That's a level of control that companies have never had over the meat business in the U.S.
I want to ask you about what got you started thinking about this, the broader we'll break the book down as we go along. But what got you thinking about the, you know, the idea in general?
That's right. And I want to say, you know, the consolidation itself is just sort of a background fact. I think what really matters to people who eat meat and people who raise meat is the effects of consolidation. What really happens when companies can get so much control over a market? For me, I became really interested in this back in 2004, and it started at the ground level. It started at seeing the kind of fallout from this level of consolidation. So I've been a business reporter in the Midwest my entire career. I moved out to Washington about a year ago for a job, but most of my life I've spent working in Arkansas and Missouri and states like that, and I kept bumping up against this industrial meat system, and the more I did so, the more fascinated I became. I mean, it's a remarkable system. You know, a modern-day chicken house is this huge warehouse-like building that's as wide as two school buses and the length of several football fields. It could have 75,000 chickens in it at a time. I mean, you walk into a building like that, and it's a memorable experience. But the seeds of this book really came in 2004 when I went to this little town of Waldron, Arkansas to report on a story there. I was told that there was a problem at this big Tyson Foods facility, which is more than a slaughterhouse. I mean, the way Tyson operates today, they own and control all the elements of production. They, at a big complex, they'll have a feed mill, they'll have a hatchery, they'll have a trucking line, they'll have the slaughterhouse. And there was a problem at this hatchery. Tyson Foods was delivering sick chickens to be raised by these local contract farmers. And when I got down there, I was really struck by the power this company had. I mean, I felt like, honestly, I was not in the United States. I was in some feudal country. I mean, you had this giant Tyson Foods plant in the middle of town. And then in the hills around it, you had these contract farmers that operated these big factory farms. But these people were so powerless. I mean, the company had so much power over them that these farmers were afraid to talk about Tyson Foods in the privacy of their own living room. They were afraid their neighbors would find out I was there. And I just thought, wow, I need to understand how companies can get this much power, how we came to be where we are, and how the system actually operates from the inside.
Well, I think it's important to say that the book is about particular characters, people that you meet along the way. It's not just broadly about economics. There are we'll mention John and Don Tyson as we go, but there are people like Jerry Yandell, and he's one of those figures who you were just referring to was affected by this particular part of the story. And I think it's important to say that it's an important part of the story are the people who are affected directly by all of this.
Absolutely. I mean, that's how I believe in putting a book together, for one thing. It's all told through the eyes of the people who live in this system, whether it's farmers like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, mm-hmm. whether it's the executives in the boardroom who are making the decisions that affect these people's lives in really intimate ways. I think it's reality is best understood through people's stories, how they see every day, the decisions they make, how things go forward through time. And that's how the book is really told. And what was amazing to me as a journalist was to get to first talk to people like Jerry and Kenita Yandell, who are on the ground level of this system and affected by it every day, but then to get the chance to talk to people they never met, like Don Tyson or his close confidant Jim Blair or mid-level executives who operate on the inside and at the upper ends of power and who make the decisions that really, really shape how rural economies work today. I mean, I talked to people who are affected by contract farming, and then I talked to people who structured those contracts, and it was a really eye-opening experience for me. You know, if I could quickly, I mean, you bring up Jerry and Kenita Yandell. That's where this book started for me. They're the couple I met in Waldron, Arkansas. They'd been in this business for over 20 years. I mean, they had built a steady middle-class life in Scott County, Arkansas through raising chickens. They worked 7 days a week, you know, 52 weeks a year. They knew nothing but hard work. And what struck me was that the way the system is structured, they were put out of business in a matter of 3 months just because Tyson Foods delivered diseased birds to their farms, which meant that they earned less income for every batch of birds they raised because almost half of them died. And it struck me that you've got this couple working as hard as they can. And in just six, you know, a few short months, they were put out of business because they got three sick flocks of birds. That's the level of economic insecurity and vulnerability the modern day chicken farmers have. And that's just a direct result of the power structure and how the rules are set and how the system works.
Okay, let's back up and talk about John Tyson, because really, in some way, the story begins with John Tyson, a man you mention in the book who never forgot the dark cloud of poverty from which he ran until the day he died. Mm-hmm. Talk about John Tyson, where he figures in the story.
It's remarkable. So back in 1929, there was the big crash and the Great Depression started. And that was just an awful time for farmers in America. And John Tyson was this guy who grew up on a farm outside of Kansas City, where I grew up. And he was sort of kicked off the family farm. His dad said, look, we're done. You got to go. And he gave his son a truck and a bale of hay. And John Tyson made it about as far south as Springdale, Arkansas, when he ran out of money. So he used what he had. He used his truck. And this guy starts shipping fruits and vegetables to market and kind of becoming a distributor. And then he starts shipping chickens, which, as you said at the beginning of the show, is kind of the specialty item back in the day. But these farmers, especially down in the South, started figuring out how to build bigger barns to raise chicken and raise more and more. And John Tyson started to make a pretty good living shipping chickens from Arkansas up to urban markets in Kansas City and St. Louis. And John had a young son, this young guy named Don Tyson, who really learned the world of business at his father's feet. So this family in the 1930s starts shipping chickens, and then they start mixing feed, delivering feed to the farmer. They build a small hatchery. They deliver the chicks to the
We just lost Christopher Leonard there. Let's see if we can get him back. Christopher Leonard, we lost you for a moment there.
I'm so sorry about that.
At the end, no, not your fault. Right at the end there. Just go back and say the last thing you said there, and I'll see if we can pick it up.
Well, yeah, I was just talking about Don Tyson and how, you know, his dad, John, was building this chicken company, which was a really new kind of chicken company where it was vertically integrated. They controlled all they made the feed. They owned the hatchery. They contracted with farmers to raise the birds.
Is that the key, by the way, that vertical integration? Because you talk about in the book, controlling the chicken farms was paramount to his success. That was his innovation, I guess, in the system.
No question about it. It was the key innovation. It's at the heart of what made Tyson Foods the biggest meat company in the U.S. Hello?
Christopher, we're having some technical problems. Give us a moment. We're going to take a break and see if we can figure this out and get back to you here in a moment. Christopher Leonard with us. His book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio, back now with the journalist Christopher Leonard. We're talking about his book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. We've got you by phone now, Christopher Leonard, which I think is going to be a little bit more reliable. Sorry about all of that.
I'm so sorry. I appreciate the time.
So let's get back to the idea of vertical integration, this idea. And because you mentioned how John Tyson developed the system where he pretty much purchased every part of the chain of production. He made the feed, as you said. He hatched the birds. But this is the thing that's so interesting. He paid the farmers to raise them. Why is that part? Why that part? Why is it that the actual raising of the birds, because this is a crucial part of the story, why was it he not interested in that part of the chain?
Yeah, that is such a great question. And, you know, this system of contract farming, born in the South back in the 40s, really borrowed its financial and economic structure from sharecropping and tenant farming. You know, it was common that, you know, you might loan a farmer a little bit of money to start going on some land, and then he'd sign a contract with someone to deliver cotton. That same sort of system was born in the chicken business. And I interviewed the people who built this system and asked them, why was it structured this way? And it's because these companies realized back in the 1960s that the farming end of this business was the least attractive as an investment.
Yeah.
You had to put up a lot of money to buy all the land, for example. You had to build these, you know, factory farming buildings that would start to lose their value pretty much the day they went up. They're not good for really anything else except for raising these animals, so you can't resell them. And it was just a bad investment. And the company decided they would much rather use their money inside the slaughterhouse to build these sophisticated machines that would give you a better rate of return. So they left the worst parts of the investment on the balance sheet of rural America. They gave that over to the farmer. They said, let's let the farmer build the buildings, buy the land. We'll let the farmer deal with the massive amounts of waste, of chicken litter that are going to come out of these houses. And so it was, you know, it was built to the benefit of the company. As any company would build a contract system to benefit itself, that's exactly what they did when it came to contract farming.
And this is the sort of nuanced part of the story as well. I mean, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to some of the criticisms coming from the industry. In particular, one piece of criticism which you've already responded to that came from the food writer, Bethany. I don't have her name in front of me.
Bethany
McLean.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that she mentions is that in some way you may have demonized, you know, the food industry or Tyson Foods in particular. But I think it's important to say, and I'll give you a chance to respond for yourself, you have a kind of it seems like a kind of affection for Don Tyson. I mean, you interviewed him twice at length for the book you mentioned. You even call him a bit of a – you may not be crazy about and you may be critical about the effect of all of this, but you seem to have a kind of affection for him. You even call him a genius in the book.
I have a tremendous amount of respect and affection toward Don Tyson. I mean, he's an incredible person. I'm lucky to have gotten to interview him twice. And it's not just Don Tyson. I mean, it's the people he brought in around him that built this company. I mean, really, in the earliest days, Tyson Foods was like Facebook. It was run out of this family's living room. They had a really interesting idea. They were entering a volatile business. And over decades, Don Tyson really inspired loyalty in his people who worked under him. He had an incredible and uncanny ability to make smart investments and grow his business. And a lot of the book tells the story of those people and what an exhilarating ride they had and what a business success Tyson Foods was. But I just can't, you know, I'm not going to shade the truth. The fact is what they built was a pretty relentless and powerful system that isn't built to represent the best interests of the farmers that grow for it, or even at the end of the day for the consumers that buy the product. And, you know, Bethany McLean in her same review said this is a picture of capitalism run amok.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's absolutely true.
Yeah, she liked the book a lot. There were just a couple of elements that she threw in there that
sure.
We're going to come back to this idea of the profits and those kinds of things as we go along, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that because it is out there. And another thing you do mention is that there have been huge benefits to consumers, this system that's been developed. You say the system sort of rewrote the biological equations that used to constrain the meat industry, for example. And I wanted you to talk about that, the fact that between 1955 and 1982, as you say in the book, they actually have been able to change the growth cycle of a chicken by 20 days. That's kind of – it's a little frightening, I have to say, in some ways, but it's pretty remarkable in others.
It is. I mean, in terms of, you know, genetically breeding these animals, they have had the pedal to the metal for decades and completely rewritten the DNA of the chicken to the point where the modern-day Cornish cross, which is what you and I would eat at McDonald's or at the grocery store counter, I mean, the thing is a walking meat machine. The breasts are built in a way that they just develop the maximum amount of meat in the shortest amount of time on the least amount of food. It's an incredible story. I will say, you know, after 6 weeks, the birds can't really walk anymore.
Right.
They are built for one purpose, which is to grow in a period of 6 weeks and then be slaughtered. And as consumers, we did see real gains from unlocking this potential and from industrializing the meat system between the 1960s and about the 1990s, there were big economies of scale as we started, you know, processing these animals at much larger slaughterhouses and things along those lines. But I think one of the things I found is that just because you industrialize the system doesn't mean you have to let it consolidate to such a huge point. It doesn't mean you have to say goodbye to open markets, to competition, to transparency, which is exactly what we have seen. And very interestingly, I want to point out that consumers got sort of an upfront benefit in the 70s and 80s from industrializing this process. But what we traded away was a competitive market, and now we're seeing the fruits of that. The inflation-adjusted cost of meat, it fell dramatically in the 70s and 80s. But then by the late 1990s, that cost curve starts to flatten out, and then it started to rise again. And now what we're seeing is that meat prices are actually rising really sharply, and there's just no doubt that a lack of competition is partly to blame for that.
You know, it's interesting. We got a response this morning. I guess Tyson Foods knew we were going to be having this conversation. They sent us a response. In a statement, they mentioned, they said, we don't set consumer prices. What we ask for our products is determined by supply and demand. This Tyson representative, a man by the name of Gary Mickelson, told us. He said, no one company is big enough to control the market, especially in today's global food environment. But give us a sense of this, because you do write about a particular moment in 2008, I believe it was, when they were having some economic difficulty. And what you allege in the book is that, in fact, Tyson did go in and set prices, in effect.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. That part of the book is based on an on-the-record interview with two senior executives at Tyson Foods, one of which is now the CEO of the company. Gary is exactly right. Tyson Foods cannot set the consumer price. Supply and demand sets the consumer price. And today, without question, Tyson Foods can not only affect the national supply of chickens, but doing so has become a centerpiece of the company's corporate strategy. Let's just talk a little bit about that vignette you mentioned from 2008. Mm. The market starts to go down. Tyson Foods is watching the price of chicken drop. It was the financial crisis. People were cutting back on their spending. So in these series of meetings, Tyson Foods leaders decided, yeah, we got to cut back supply. What's remarkable is that Tyson Foods has now the capability to cut back supply of 22% of the national market. No company's ever been that powerful before. From a central office, Tyson Foods can literally control the number of birds placed on its network of 4,000 chicken farms around the country. I mean, a huge portion of rural America's chicken farms are under the control of one company, and it cut back supplies, it reduced the number of chicks it put out on those farms, and the price of a boneless, skinless breast of chicken rose within a matter of weeks. Let me point out, to Gary's point, Tyson Foods controls about 20% of the market. Its only real competitor, Pilgrim's Pride, controls another 20% of the market. That means together just two firms can control 40% of the market. They don't need to have a secret meeting in a smoky back room to coordinate production cuts. They can just watch what the other is doing and cut in tandem, and then all of a sudden you've got 40% of the U.S. chicken supply contracting in a way that raises prices. This has been happening every year since at least 2007, documented. The companies talk about it in their earnings conference calls. And I'd like to make a quick point. I came across a remarkable lawsuit from 1977 in which the Department of Justice sued 36 chicken companies for cutting supplies to raise prices. What's different today is that two companies control what 36 companies used to control. So now they don't have to collude. They don't have to have a meeting.
Yeah.
They can just do it from one office.
But that is the question that comes up throughout the book. I mean, we mentioned the old meat trust days in the early 1900s, which, as you point out, was a system that you say was broken by government regulation, in particular by Teddy Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
So why is it that in the 20th century, when this was sort of playing out, or the 21st century as it was evolving, why didn't the government get involved and see this coming, or work to sort of, you know, to temper all of this?
Yeah. That's such a great question, and I've been studying this a lot, and the answers really are not all that complicated. I mean, first of all, the industry was allowed to consolidate back in the 70s and 80s, and I think that was largely because the companies could say, hey, look, we are making meat cheaper. By industrializing the system, we're making it cheaper, and that benefits consumers. Don't worry if competition disappears. Don't worry if just a few companies gain so much control of the market. And just by and large, regulators in Washington and public policy thinkers really embraced that idea that, you know, monopoly itself isn't bad as long as these companies deliver low prices. Walmart, another perfect example of that. But I think the lesson of history is really quite simple. When companies gain market power, they use it. Once they have control over the levers of a market, they use them to their own benefit. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. You know, I show in the book how over the decades there have been a few concerted fights against this, and they've mostly lost. You know, the most significant effort happened in 2009 when Barack Obama was elected president. He came in really on a campaign platform of reforming these problems. You know, back in Iowa in 2007, Barack Obama put himself to the left of Hillary Clinton and said, look, we're going to face this problem of consolidation in corporate agribusiness. And Obama appointed a team of really ardent reformers. They drew up these antitrust reforms that would have been the most sweeping passed since the Great Depression. But what unfolded was really amazing and simple. The meat industry and the meat lobbyists in Washington, who have a ton of money and are really effective at what they do, worked the halls of Congress and ultimately beat back this effort. So you ask, why could we do it back in 1900? Why isn't it happening today? And I really think the answer is that, you know, in Teddy Roosevelt, you had a president who relished conflict. He was not afraid to stand up and say, we need to break up trust to stimulate economic growth and to increase competition, and he was willing to take on entrenched interests who fought back, whereas the Obama administration just doesn't seem to have the appetite for a fight. Mm. Once the meat industry started running ads against it and working the halls of Congress, the administration just started retreating immediately, and you never saw them articulate the argument of why breaking up monopolies is actually good for the economy, why it stimulates competition, creates jobs, brings transparency to markets. They never wanted to, or rather, they just never did articulate that argument, and the reform efforts dried up completely and have disappeared.
Well, it's so interesting because the last part of the book is about these efforts to reform the system by the Obama administration and what happened. And you tell this story about how President Obama lost the public narrative during this story. And so you have, in essence, this remarkable story playing out in 2010, March it is, where you have the Justice Department and you have the Agriculture Department in a sort of unprecedented way putting together these hearings. And in during all of this, you say, they make the case, Tom Vilsack in particular, the Secretary of Agriculture, talks about the status of the American farmer and the plight for rural America, makes this really powerful case. But then it starts to break down. How is it that we go from there where Tom Vilsack and the Obama administration is making this powerful case for the decline of rural America and the small American farmer? And then when he has his chance a little bit later during the campaign, you can play this story out for us a little bit. But it's interesting because that's what the last part of the book is about, is how this all breaks down.
Absolutely. And the only thing that changes is the political calculation within the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which I have to assume was also tied into the White House. The only thing that changed is they decided they didn't want to take on this fight. As you point out, March 2010, Tom Vilsack has the bully pulpit, the public platform. He's talking about deep concerns for rural America. Fast forward to the fall of 2011, and he's going around publicly boasting. I mean, literally, 180-degree turn, he's boasting about economic growth in rural America as kind of a campaign slogan for why Obama should be reelected. None of the fundamental underlying trends changed at all, except you could argue they got worse during that time. What changed was the opposition that the USDA was facing, the concerted battle by the lobbyists. And, you know, I interviewed the people who were inside USDA at that time, mm-hmm. taking the heat. And it really divided USDA. They started to argue with each other. They got fractured. Some people were saying, this is just politically inconvenient. It's not realistic. We need to back off of this. Those reformers I mentioned who'd been appointed started leaving. They started quitting. They weren't invited to meetings anymore. And there was just a political calculation that either this fight isn't worth it, we don't feel like we can articulate the argument here, we're going to lose this fight, whatever the case may be, they started backing off. And then that really played to the advantage of the meat industry lobbyists, because as the delays built and the scaling back started to happen, they were able to use their allies in Congress to speak out against this stuff. And so they had the momentum, and that's really how the effort was killed.
Let's talk about the contracts that Tyson created with these local farmers. Explain what they're like. They're really... And how did they start? Who was the one that started in it? Was it Don who started creating these contracts, or was it John Tyson that started creating these really restrictive contracts with the local farmers?
Well, you know, the original contracts, John Tyson did some of the earliest, most simple contracts. But the system as it exists today really was refined under Don Tyson and some really smart legal minds around him, like his general counsel, Jim Blair. And it's fascinating. I mean, first of all, the terms of these contracts started getting worse and worse and worse for chicken farmers as the industry consolidated. As competition went away, these farmers had fewer choices of who to deal with. I mean, I just rattled off all those figures about how consolidated the market is. That really understates the problem, because in the towns where Tyson operates and the companies like it, they're regional monopolies. You know, so if I'm a chicken farmer in Waldron, Arkansas, I don't really have a choice of who I'm going to do business with. I might be lucky and have two companies to choose from, but that's not real competition. So you see the terms of these contracts slowly start to grind down the farmer and get to the point where they're so advantageous for the company. And I can walk through what a modern contract looks like today. It's pretty remarkable. First of all, I want to point out these contracts are secret by their very nature. They're private, secret contracts. And what that means is we've replaced transparent wholesale markets for animals. I mean, you look at hogs. Decades ago, or even years ago, there used to be a transparent price for hogs. Farmers could look at this price and realize what was fair. And it was like a share of IBM. The price went up and down. It was determined by buyers and sellers. Now, the price of a hog or the price of a chicken is determined by secret contract terms that are determined by how good a negotiating farmer is with Tyson Foods. And, you know, the price of a chicken today is determined by one of the most troubling elements of these contracts, which is the tournament system. What that says is that if I raise chickens for Tyson Foods, I don't just get paid based on how much weight these birds gain on a price per pound basis. What Tyson does is it'll take all the farmers in an area who delivered chickens in a given week, and then it'll rank them against each other. It'll rank them based on how much weight they put on the birds on the given amount of feed that Tyson provided them. What's critical is that the tournament's a zero-sum game. You know, you take a pool of farmers, you rank them against each other. They all might have done a fantastic job and beat all the industry benchmarks, had a home run week, but by necessity, the top half will take money from the bottom half, no matter how well they all did. So that effectively divides these farmers against each other. They know they're competing against their neighbor for a paycheck. And critically, the farmer can't control the main criteria for success in the tournament. The main criteria for success is how healthy those baby chicks are when Tyson delivers them, and how good the feed is that they eat, the quality of the feed. So it really ends up being more like a lottery for these farmers. They hope Tyson delivers good chicks and good feed. They'll do their best, and then they just sort of see how they rank in the tournament against their neighbors.
Here's something we got from the National Chicken Council related to this idea of the tournament. In reality, this spokesperson told us, the tournament is a performance-based system where everyone benefits, including the farmers who are compensated according to the quality and care of their chickens, and the consumers who can count on feeding their family safe, healthy, and affordable chicken year-round. So, I mean, what they're saying is it doesn't put one against another, that they're fairly compensated. That's been their response, I guess.
That response is completely at odds with reality, plain and simple. This book is not based, the Meat Racket's not based on interviews with farmers. It's based on the internal documents of the companies themselves, their settlement sheets, the equations they use for the tournament, dozens of interviews, and lawsuits. I mean, there's a mountain of civil litigation based on this stuff, civic investigations by the USDA. To say that the tournament benefits everybody is directly at odds with the nature of the tournament itself, which is a zero-sum game that rewards some farmers at the expense of others. I mean, that's not even a legitimate argument. The better argument I heard came from a senior executive at Tyson Foods, who's retired now, named David Pirtle, who ran the tournament for many years and helped run the chicken operation. He said, look, we need farmers to reinvest in the equipment on their farm, and this is a way to keep them under the thumb of the company or motivated, if you will, in a way that they constantly need to reinvest to try to do better in the tournament. And that's the way that Tyson Foods and companies like it can try to ensure that these farmers have the most expensive and modern equipment possible. Now, that's an honest answer. That's a businessman's answer, and you can't blame the company for trying to do what's in its best interest. Again, I think in the public interest, you have to think about, do we want a competitive market or one where these firms can just dictate terms to farmers?
You mentioned that, and we should point out, we're not just talking about chicken here. I mean, Tyson Foods, of course, pigs, hogs, of course. But also, you mentioned that the cattle industry so far has been a holdout against vertical integration. But you say you're starting to see, what, signs that they're starting to buckle?
Absolutely. Yeah, part two of the book, there's a word for vertically integrated production. It's called chickenized. You know, these people out in rural America talk about a business becoming chickenized. Part two of the book's called The Great Chickenization, and it shows how these really smart companies in the 70s realized that they could vertically integrate hog production and make a ton of money. It was like a big corporate takeover. There was a very prosperous hog industry in the United States characterized by large, mid-sized producers who were all independent, and these companies came in with contract operations and wiped out that market. We lost 90% of our hog farms in the 80s and 90s as it was taken over by these contract producers like Smithfield Foods, Tyson Foods, and others. They could do that to the hog industry because they cracked the code of how to raise pigs in a big factory farm. They literally took these chicken houses you and I have been talking about and started putting hogs in them and just figuring out how you could raise hogs like that. It was a tough thing to figure out. It took many years, but they finally figured out how to do it. They've never been able to really figure that out for a cow, and that's kind of due to the biology of the cow. A mother cow will have a single calf at a time, not a big litter or a continuous stream of eggs like a chicken. And for that reason, it's just not really economically viable to have a mother and a calf in a factory barn their whole life. You have to spend a lot of money feeding them. It just doesn't really earn out. So for that reason, you've got these cattle born out on ranches still. But at the end of their life, they're going to spend the last few months on the feedlots. And those are the big concentrated feedlots your listeners might have heard about. Mm-hmm. And it's at that level that companies like Tyson and Cargill and JBS are starting to gain control of the market through their contracts. They're suffocating the open cash market for cattle and replacing it with contracts. So they're kind of achieving vertical integration through contract, if you will. They're starting to take over at the feedlot level and push down from there.
That's Christopher Leonard. His book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Christopher Leonard. We're talking about his book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. What, you know, a question comes up. What is the life of a chicken like? What do you make of that question? What it's like for a chicken in this
sure.
kind of things?
You know, a typical chicken today is born from a hen who lives in a cage about the size of her body in a laying house, and the egg in many cases will be dropped right down onto a conveyor belt, go down the belt, be dropped on a tray. The tray is shipped to a giant building called a hatchery where these trays are stacked up. It's sort of like a server farm, but with trays of eggs, and they're agitated and warmed at exactly the right specifications so that they then hatch. They're in a crate. Their crates are stacked onto a truck. The truck drives them to a farm. The birds are dumped out onto the ground. They live in this chicken house for maybe 6 weeks, and then they're brought back and slaughtered. And in the same building, they're slaughtered. They're cooked and turned into nuggets, tenders, chicken wings, you name it, and stacked in these pallets in these frozen rooms and then shipped out on trucks to Walmart and McDonald's. You know, importantly, that chicken, its entire life, from egg to McNugget, never brushes up against an open market, by the way. It's never bought or sold by anybody. It's owned by Tyson Foods the whole time. And that's one of the reasons why, as we've said, chicken became the cheapest and most plentiful meat in the U.S. The chicken is sort of the industrial animal. It's the first animal they really learned how to raise its whole life like a widget in a factory. And it's a pretty remarkable system, and that's why it's become so cheap and efficient.
It's interesting. You, among the characters that you talked to, one stuck out to me, a woman by the name of Eunice Richardson. Mm. This elderly chicken farmer in Danville, Arkansas, writes in all caps this letter to her, I think it's to her congressman or to the Obama administration. And I, what was interesting about it is she's writing to sort of oppose the efforts to reform the system. Talk a little bit about her and what that tells you about the way things are working.
I'm so glad you brought that up. It was sad to me. This was when the Obama administration was trying to change that tournament system you and I had talked about. They were trying to turn it into an actual incentive system where you would give a bonus to farmers, but at least give them a floor. I mean, because the tournament, if you're at the bottom of the tournament, you're going out of business. You're going to be paid so little, you will not make money, you will be put out of business. It is literally financial life or death arrangement. So when Obama's team said, we're going to try to create a floor for farmers, the National Chicken Council, the same group you just read that quote from, they mobilized and they put out a memo that was later uncovered by the media, a memo with these talking points. They went to big companies like Tyson and said, give this memo to your chicken farmers who right now know you can put them out of business overnight and ask them to relay these talking points to federal officials. Eunice in near Waldron, Arkansas, did exactly that. She told me over the phone that the field techs for the local poultry company brought her a statement, gave her the statement. She mailed it to the USDA, and it said, please don't do away with the tournament. It creates competition and innovation. I mean, literally a Xerox of what the National Chicken Council had sent out. Unbelievably, you know, Eunice went out of business a year later. She couldn't cover the costs of operation, and she went out of business. And what was telling to me about it was this sort of resignation and acceptance she felt about the whole situation, that sort of that's life, that I'll survive. I've got Social Security. I mean, the power that these companies have where they operate, where they really do business, the power is so complete that they face no true challenge from the ground level anymore from the people that work with them or provide them animals.
You say the 40 years between 1969 and 2009 is a good period to measure the economic impact of Tyson. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that. What are we learning? Because you say nearly 70% of the counties where Tyson operates, per capita income has grown more slowly than the state average. This sense, because let me offer another comment from Gary Mickelson of Tyson Foods. He says Tyson is one of the leading supporters of American farmers. They've paid more than $15 billion last year to thousands of independent farmers. They mentioned in the statement to us that some of these farmers have been raising livestock and poultry for the company for decades, in some cases multiple generations. Tyson, he says, depends on them, want them to succeed. So what's the economic impact of Tyson in the scheme of things?
Well, I mean, first of all, Tyson might have paid out $15 billion to farmers, but just think about the scale of the company's operations. I mean, that doesn't represent what those farmers might have actually earned in a competitive system, not by a long shot. I think more study needs to be done at our public universities about the impact of this kind of consolidation and vertical integration on rural communities. I can tell you what I've seen. I mean, you take per capita income for these counties going back to 1969, and it just shows a clear pattern that companies like Tyson, they go to economically marginal places to set up shop, and they keep those places economically marginal as they operate there because they have a relentless focus on pushing down what they pay to farmers and to workers at the slaughterhouse, by the way. Mm. And there's not viable competition to come in and stimulate higher payments to these people. What was really interesting to me is that when you look at that per capita income by county, you see that the effect is the most pronounced and the worst in Arkansas, where Tyson is really rooted and where it's been based for decades. Fully 90% of the counties where Tyson does business in Arkansas saw slower income growth than the state as a whole between 1969 and 2009. So again, that tells me that while Tyson has seen a meteoric rise in its profits over the decades, the counties where it operates haven't seen the same benefit. They've been stagnating, and really you just get the sense of almost treading water all of these years.
Well, here's how you put it in the book. You say many parts of rural America in general can look to Arkansas if they want to see their future.
That's exactly right. And I think to refine that point a little bit more, you know, we're talking about the chickenization of these businesses and ranchers who are starting to sign more contracts with these companies, hog farmers who are saying they can't make it in the independent market anymore, so they're going to get into the contract system. This book, more than anything, is an urgent message to them to look at their future and see what happens when you lose open markets, when you lose competition. The results of power like this are completely predictable and they're simple. The companies rewrite the rules in their favors. Rural America gets squeezed. People who raise meat get squeezed. And that's really important for our rural communities because raising meat is still a pathway to the middle class in a lot of these places. And they're just losing the ability to make a good living as the consolidation increases.
You know, it's interesting. It's hard to see. You seem not cynical, but certainly skeptical. You say it's unclear if anything is going to change the pattern where it's headed. I mean, and the obvious question comes up, which you write a bit about, this local, you know, this local vorm movement, the idea of buying food locally, getting it from local, you know, chicken farmers. It's so much more expensive. You talk about that you don't see that necessarily changing the trend, at least, I guess.
I really don't. I mean, it's not realistic to expect you and I or normal, you know, middle-class Americans are going to get all their meat from these types of local producers who sell at the farmer's market. I mean, if we want to eat meat, and I do think meat is an affordable source of protein that's important for a diet, I've been getting a lot of heat, frankly, from the vegetarian crowd for that, but
sure.
I do believe it. And it brings us to this question of how we structure this industry. I just think we're going to have a certain level of industrialization to really supply a huge population with meat around the clock. But does that mean that we have to let four companies dominate the system to the point where they're not answerable to the laws of supply and demand, where they can depress what they pay farmers, where they can manipulate supplies to keep prices high for consumers, and we lose actual choice at the grocery store? I think my point is that we've gotten to the point where the free market can't correct itself. That's what happens when you get monopoly problems. There are high barriers to entry for competition, and we need some sort of outside public policy solution to this. And it can be done. The solutions aren't rocket science. We faced this problem before. We solved the problem. But unfortunately, it takes political will. And at this point, it's a matter of taking on really well-moneyed and entrenched corporate interest to do it.
You write about Don Tyson. He had struggled for years with liver cancer, dies in January of 2011. But you mentioned that, you know, as he knew he was he only had so much time left, that he got his affairs in order, structured his company, you say, so that his leadership would endure. He was pushing for visionary change and visionary growth in his company. I wanted you to say something about that finally. He wants Tyson to go global.
Yeah. When I met him at the end of his life, he was most excited about Tyson's operations in China, Brazil, and India. And the thinking is, Tyson really can't get any bigger in the United States. There's no way it's going to be able to buy out Pilgrim's Pride and single-handedly control 40% of the market. And we've sort of seen a saturation, if you will. But the story is really different overseas. In countries like Brazil and India and China, you're seeing a growing affluent middle class. And they are sort of where we were back in the 60s and 70s in terms of the rise of fast food restaurants, prepared foods at grocery store, more meat consumption. And the idea is Tyson could perhaps ride that wave again in the developing world, sort of grow up alongside fast food franchises in Brazil or India, and build out a system of factory farms identical to the one that now dominates rural America. So that's sort of the idea of how you could double the stock price of Tyson Foods, for example, how they could sort of replicate the amazing economic growth they've had in the United States. Because domestically, they're just a lot like Walmart. You know, Walmart can't retake over small-town retail in the same way Tyson can't retake over the rural meat-producing system.
That's Christopher Leonard, a fellow at the nonpartisan think tank, the New America Foundation. His book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. He joined us from the studios of NPR in Washington. And Christopher Leonard, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much for your time.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.